You're listening to The Writer's Voice on Virginia Voice. I'm Jennifer Robbins Riley, your host. Today we have Virginia author J. Keith McMullen in the studio. His first book is titled Missing Mary, A Crash Course in Alzheimer's Dementia. And I just have to say, this is a really wonderful book. It's a very humorous memoir of Keith's mother. She had the diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia. So, Keith, thank you very much for being in the studio today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And I want to start out with you describing your mother, okay?
Sure.
She was described in the book so eloquently, and I want you to describe her to our listeners.
Sure. I think it might be helpful. I can read a paragraph from the introduction about her.
Sure.
Or probably the first piece of information, as any caregiver would be thinking, is I grew up within a mile of four generations. So my entire life, I was always surrounded by many generations of family. So within a mile was my mom, and my dad lived with her for many, many years until he died, and my great aunt Clara also lived with her, and then I was married and my kids. So it was always multi-generational, and taking care of seniors is just something I've always known. So that's really probably the foundation for the book. And honestly, people often ask me, how did I become a caregiver? Because I am an unlikely caregiver. I'm not the oldest. I'm not the daughter. I'm not what you might traditionally think. But I always answer the question of how do you become a caregiver by saying, answer the phone.
Okay.
So as I answered the phone, right, it sometimes would be my mother's doctor. Sometimes it would be my great aunt. Sometimes it would be a clinician. But all by answering the phone consistently was really how I ended up providing care for my mother with Alzheimer's.
Okay.
So obviously anyone can be a caregiver. But here's from the introduction. Mary McMullen, Miss Mary to her fans, was a do-right woman, brilliant mathematician, champion athlete, member of America's greatest generation, and the hand behind the best Christmas cookies ever. She may have been a force of energy and one of the first women faculty at the University of Richmond in the 1960s and 70s, but she was a caregiver first, not only to her three children, but also to elderly neighbors and friends, her aunt, my aging father, our pet gerbil, and assorted dogs, and me, her lucky middle son. With the spirit of a champion, Miss Mary lived life gracefully, even as Alzheimer's dementia tracked her down, took hold, and refused to let go. Extending a hand to help her navigate the dark path of this cruel disease was my most difficult and most worthwhile journey in life.
Wow, that is mm-hmm. so profound. And I have really been enjoying reading your book because my grandmother, she had dementia. And her name was Mary. And so this has just been such a wonderful read for me. And I've really been learning a lot, too, about Alzheimer's and dementia. So I want to ask you this question, and maybe you've been asked this before. What was your motivation behind writing Missing Mary, A Crash Course in Alzheimer's Dementia? Because you are a very busy man. You have a career in healthcare, and you're a top executive within your company. And how did this happen? How did you come to write this book?
So I'm, you know, in many ways, I think the answer, you know, to that question, you know, as you're trying to make sense of the senseless, and with Alzheimer's and dementia and diminishing a person, any person, my mother included, I'm trying to make sense of that. And going through that process, you know, almost in a journaling type of way. I think for any caregiver, and you know, there are like 15 million caregivers in the United States now for someone with dementia. But for anyone, I think just going through that process, and then dealing with that process, I think many folks like myself turn to writing in a journal, or something just to begin processing that. But professionally, I work a great deal with doctors, both MDs and PhDs, as well as healthcare consultants. And of course, they're all writing books, right? If you're a PhD, you're looking for tenure. If you're an MD, you're looking to prove evidence-based medicine. If you're a consultant, that's the nature of the gig, publishing on a topic and then speaking on that topic. So of course, when they asked me what I was going to write on and I said Alzheimer's, they said, are you crazy? And of course I was. But the reality is, I really thought it was the story that was within me. And having gone through the experience, I really thought that that was the story that I had to tell, not only because of my mother and the remarkable person who she was, but also just going through the experience as an unlikely caregiver. And in my brain, I often thought, if I was to buy a beer for a buddy who had a parent with dementia, what is it that I would want to share? What is it that I think would be helpful? Because so often, I think with being a caregiver with Alzheimer's, the reality is every day it's a shifting landscape. You can never predict how the day is going to play out. It's very moment by moment in that caregiver role. And I think with such an ever-shifting and changing landscape, I thought that if there was a story that I could tell to help a person navigate that type of terrain, that it would be well worth the effort.
You said in your book, managing and understanding senior healthcare was one of the hardest jobs you've ever had. Explain a little bit to our listeners why it was so challenging and hard.
So usually when I'm asked questions like that, and again, I worked in disease management for years and years, and I was working in disease management with cardiovascular disease, diabetes, other conditions like that, that very much have cures, treatments, and things like that. But of course, with Alzheimer's, there is no cure. There is no treatment.
Right.
So certainly dealing with that, you know, becomes such a challenge. But I often say growing up a mile from my mother and my great aunt and my family, I often say with caregiving, the reality is there's always a light bulb that needs to be changed.
Right.
And so my friends, right, would classically say, what are you talking about? But the reality is if you live a mile from your mother in her 80s and your great aunt in her 90s, there's always this light bulb that's burned out. They need you to come over and change it. And if you don't, it looks like this. It looks like literally the light bulb in the hall of our house would be out. And my mother, who is, you know, 80, in her 80s with dementia, and my great aunt, who's in her 90s, my great aunt would be holding a cane chair circa 1900. My mother would be getting up in the chair to change that light bulb. And then, of course, she would be confused and wondering, which way do I turn this, right? And then my great aunt would be saying, right, lefty Lucy, turn it to the left. So this huge thing goes on for changing a light bulb. And of course, if they were to fall, or if my mother was to fall out of the chair, by that hall is a stairwell. So then they both would have fallen down the stairs, right? It's such a mess. And so I may have hundreds of cousins who would have gladly called me, you know, to be able to say, why did I kill Aunt Clara? But out of those 100 relatives, would anyone have been willing to help take care of them? Not so much, but they would have been glad to ask in terms of we had had an accident. So that, I always just think that's how it plays out every day. There are these small things that seem so simple, but the reality is nothing is.
Wow. Well, you took over a big undertaking, and it's very admirable. You had to deal with quite a bit, and I like how you used a lot of humor throughout your book. So I'm sure through the process there was a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety and that sort of thing, because I mean it's a big responsibility taking care of someone with dementia and Alzheimer's. So what did you do to relieve the stress?
Yeah. And coping mechisms, that's always a good question. And I always think with Alzheimer's, with the tyrant Alzheimer's, your personal agenda means nothing. So however I would want to spend my day, or what I would want to do, or how I would want to take care of my mother, though that agenda never plays out. It's always what the patient needs, or what your mother needs, or your great aunt. And those really become the priority. So I think in terms of stress, or in terms of challenges, one of the main challenges is the amount of energy that it takes, the amount of unplanned activity that it takes, as well as I've certainly described Alzheimer's as a hyperabsorber of resources, right? It absorbs your time, absorbs your energy, absorbs your money, it can really absorb mm-hmm. a person or a family almost in entirety. So the question is so important of, amidst that type of stress and challenge, how do you take a break? And I used to say the true reality is I'm not the person with Alzheimer's.
Right.
And if I begin behaving in such a way that Alzheimer's is taking over my life as much as my mother's, then truthfully, Alzheimer's almost wins doubly. So it's very important for me to draw back and to have times that were for me and for me as the caregiver and not just being a full-time person trying to manage Alzheimer's. But I always say, when the question comes up, I always say, I do what everybody does. You do what you know.
You didn't turn to drinking, though.
No, so well, good. I did, but only...
you did that on the side a little.
Moderate amounts.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of beer, but setting that aside. But the
right.
But with the stress of caregiving, I remember reading in a textbook, and because I've worked in healthcare for so long, I had easy access to countless books, articles, physicians, nurses, you know, all who work with geriatric patients.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember reading this book about all of the ways to deal with stress, right? And they went on, and I had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. And, you know, I was like, how in the world, you know, does this play
right.
out in real life? But then I realized, you know, for me, I do understand exactly what they're talking about, whether it's, you know, clinical terms for deep breathing or meditation, those sorts of things.
Right.
But I thought, I really do know what they're talking about. It's just that I call it kayaking.
Okay.
And so,
kayaking, a lot of kayaking here in Richmond, that's for
right?
sure.
Right, yeah, absolutely. So would you like me to read a few paragraphs
yes, would
on
you?
That?
Yeah, everybody wants to know how to relax these days.
Right. So again, this was just the exercise that I did, but of course you could do whatever you prefer, whatever you enjoy. But here's a couple of paragraphs. In the early morning light, the fresh water of the James moved at a fast clip over the rocks I needed to avoid. Fastening my life preserver, I lowered the kayak from the dock to the water's surface and slid in, freezing my ass off in the hard plastic seat. With paddle in both hands, I took a stroke and moved to the middle of the river. I would not be cold for long. I paddled upstream against the current as morning light painted a watercolor sky. I paddled through rising morning steam. Stately great blue herons patiently fished and watched me paddle by. With no signs of another human being, I was the sole owner of the James River waterfront. King David and Great Aunt Clara whispered their song. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim His handiwork. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. Psalm 19. At a bend before the Willie Bridge, the water smoothed. I sat perfectly still in the kayak and took 10 slow strokes in rhythm with 10 deep breaths, focusing on the paddle entering the water and the ripples it sent out. As I paddled toward Bosher's Dam, the river's current strengthened, as did each stroke I made, using only my arms and holding my body and kayak still to maximize efficiency and speed. As the James River poured over the dam in a powerful waterfall, I hung back about 4 feet from the waterfall's edge to prevent being sucked down into the mighty vortex. A bald eagle fished the dam without fear, singing his male soprano song. He flew directly at the river and with precision snatched a smallmouth bass in his right yellow talon. Large black wings unfurled, and with a flash of white tail feathers, he raised above the water and perched on the branch of a dead tree to eat this morning's catch, his watchful yellow eye making sure I kept my distance.
I love that.
So probably that for me was certainly how I took a break. And even though the James River is just about a mile from my house, obviously I went far, far away in my soul.
And it really helped.
For me, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But, and then I really drew the analogy in terms of caregiving and using what you know. I referred to it as the kayak method.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew how to put the paddle in the water and take a stroke. And so that's really how I defined my approach to caregiving was every day I put put the paddle in the water and took a stroke and did one thing. So whether it was calling Medicare, whether it was calling the doctor, taking my mother to the podiatrist, I just kept that rhythm and doing something, you know, every day for my mom. And of course, I think by doing that, I was really able to find a piece of peace amongst all of the chaos and confusion.
Right, because you had to deal with so much, like wills.
It was endless.
And estates. I mean, you were virtually doing everything.
It was a
lot. Not only for your mother, but you were doing it for your aunt Clara, who lived to be 99 years old, and she was taking care of your mom.
All I'll say is she was the world's most special person. I never begrudged helping her.
Right.
But obviously, there were always light bulbs that needed to be changed.
She sounded like an amazing woman.
She was extremely
special. I mean, she lived
to
99 years old, and she was taking care. She was a caregiver for your mother.
So I loved her very much. And I'll say this. When my mother went to the emergency room, was really how the profound awareness that my mother had dementia really played out in an emergency room, as so often the case with an acute care need. But I remember when I was in the emergency room and the doctor was so mad. My mother had driven herself. He knew instantly that she had dementia and health concerns, right?
Sure.
And of course, she was living with my great aunt and had forever. And so I was in the emergency room, and he said, you know, do you live with your mom? And I said, well, no, you know, I live nearby, you know, I have my own family, you know.
Right.
And he said, well, who does live with her? And I said, oh, you know, my Aunt Clara.
I thought that was funny, and she's like
said,
95 years
right,
old.
Right, and he said, oh, so Aunt Clara looks after your mom. And I said, no, not so much. And he said, how old is Aunt Clara? And I was like, well, 98. And so I remember
He said. He probably had a look on his face like, oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. We definitely, you know, it was definitely Houston, we have a problem.
Well, you're listening to The Writer's Voice on Virginia Voice. I'm Jennifer Robbins Riley, your host, and our guest today is local author Keith McMullen, and his first book is titled Missing Mary, A Crash Course on Alzheimer's Dementia. I want to talk a little bit now about family dynamics.
Oh, sure.
You know, there's a lot going on with the family.
Yeah.
This is a serious disease you're dealing with your mother, and how did that all play out? I mean, you have brothers and sisters, and it seemed like you were the one doing a lot of the work.
Right.
So you want to talk about that briefly
about
the dynamics.
I work for Bon Secours Health System now, and I work a great deal with hospice and home care. And I was talking to a social worker recently who works with families all day, every day. And I was asking her, you know, in terms of her experience, you know, how does this usually play out with caregiving? And she said in all the cases that she's ever seen, with the exception of one, and she's probably been a social worker for 25 years with families. She said, I've only seen it work out once where the workload responsibility was shared evenly. And she said one time she worked with a family that had three sons, and they literally divided the year into three, and each one took their mother for a portion of that time, and it really did work out with shared responsibility. And she said outside of that one time, she's never seen it work, and it ends up that one person and really does become the primary caregiver with two real focuses. One focus is the caregiving need, the healthcare need, and the other focus is the business need or the financial end of caregiving. So those are the two big buckets. So it did end up that I was out of default. I did end up becoming my mother's caregiver.
Was that because you had the healthcare background, or just kind of happened that way?
You know, all of those dynamics, right? All of those dynamics play out. And I remember, you know, the line by Leo Tolstoy, you know, the famous Russian author, and he said, you know, all happy families are just alike, but unhappy families are unhappy in their own way.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, with Alzheimer's, it's essentially back up a truck, you know, full of unhappiness and misery, and dump it all over a family and then see how you manage. So pretty much, I think my advice on that is good luck.
I was just going to say, what is your advice to other families out there? Just
best
good
of luck.
Luck.
And by all means, you know, you can read my book, Missing Mary, and you'll know exactly what not to do.
Well, I think you have a lot of patience. You're a pretty special man because you really did virtually everything.
It's a lot of work.
A lot of work, really, for sure.
For us, the complication was also my wife's father was dying of Alzheimer's at the same time.
Right.
And his sister died of Alzheimer's. My grandmother died of Alzheimer's. It's just a disease I've always known.
Wow. So you have a lot of that in your family.
I've always known it.
This is a question, I don't know if you've been asked this before. Did you learn anything about yourself that you didn't know before you wrote the book?
Oh, sure. My gosh.
Just curious about that.
Almost, you know, I'm sure there was something almost daily that I learned, whether good, bad, or indifferent about myself. But
What's the biggest thing you learned?
Well, the thing that I was always so struck by, when my mother, at end of life, she had died, and, you know, we had a funeral and those sorts of things. And I remember after she died, I got hundreds of notes. And I got so many notes from people who had known her sometime, you know, over the, you know, 83 years that she lived. And of course, some were students, some were teachers, some were, you know, golf, people she played golf with and bridge with and all these things. And every single note that I got, essentially was describing how she made them feel special, and loved. And none of the notes talked about any of her many noteworthy accomplishments.
Wow.
And I thought at the end of the day, it's so much, life is so much about how you make another person feel. And frankly, science is proving that also. Emotional memory really is the strongest type of memory. And how a person makes you feel is what we recall the longest. More than words, more than smell, more than sounds. It really is emotional memory that's the strongest. So I try to respect that.
Oh, that's very touching. Do you want to read any excerpts from your book, Keith, that you just want our listeners to hear?
And
that,
I,
you know, maybe some of your favorite excerpts from the book? We have a little bit of time.
I'll read the ones that are most requested. How about that? The audience favorites. This first one, just to put it into a time frame.
Okay.
This was when my mother had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and she was really, frankly, she was self-diagnosed. She knew that her mind was slipping, and she knew that she had dementia, and she was very well aware and had the ability to assess herself and her surroundings until the end.
Wow.
So they often say about Alzheimer's, when you've met one person with Alzheimer's dementia, you've met one person with Alzheimer's dementia. So that assessment skill really never did leave her. She had Alzheimer's, you know, been diagnosed, and then we had lots of questions in terms of the things that I needed to do, and we began working with a caseworker. And so this is a section from what the caseworker had suggested that I do. We called her Martha Poppins. She then outlined for me the first phase of a sensible plan of action to begin addressing my mother's confusion with money. Number one, one pocketbook with an easy clasp. Number two, one wallet that is easy to use and easy to take in and out of her pocketbook. Number three, one credit card capped at no more than $1,000 with power of attorney paperwork on file at the bank. Number four, front and back copies of all cards and identification stored in a file. So on a Saturday after soccer practice, my son and I decided to swing by Grammy Mary's house to implement this prudent care plan. We would go down the list and check things off one by one, starting with one pocketbook with an easy clasp. I figured the list would take about an hour, and then we would take Grammy Mary to lunch at Bogart's with Legend Beer on tap. James, wearing soccer shorts and cleats, headed upstairs with Grammy Mary to the bedroom. She opened the cedar closet door and began handing him purses. He placed the first one on the bed, then a second, third, a dozen, two dozen, three dozen. The purses covered the queen bed, and I entered a state of shock. I had no idea how to respond to a lifetime of purses. This blue one matches Spectator pumps. I carry the crocodile clutch for years. The commentary coming out of my mother's mouth was Greek to James and me, and we had no idea what Spectator pumps were. Thankfully, my son had no problem with the process. One by one, he turned the purses upside down and dumped out artifacts. We made a mountain of lipstick, tissues, change, cards, certs, bobby pins, ink pens, safety pins. Grammy Mary said the magic words, "James, why don't you keep all the money you find for working with me today?" Purses flew open.
That's great.
Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah,
let me know.
We have time to read one more small excerpt, and then I'm gonna ask you where folks can find your information.
Oh, sure.
And then we'll close up.
I'll read another page. So the way that I wrote the book, Exploring Memory, I often flashed back and flashed back to a memory from childhood and a memory of my mother, and then compared it with her as a senior with dementia. Of course, the contrast, you know, of course, was so striking of who the person was, so high functioning, but then also really, I think, helped illustrate dementia and Alzheimer's and its impact on a person. So I'll read a paragraph or two out of here. This is from when I was a kid and going on vacation. Of all the relatives to visit, none was more fun than Uncle Bob. Outside of Lexington, Kentucky, we would pull off the main road, open the gate to his horse farm, and drive up the twisting gravel driveway to the brick colonial house on top of the hill. A big man with an impressive belly, Uncle Bob always greeted us in jeans and cowboy boots with a big, "How do?" Uncle Bob's idea of farming was more like Noah than Old MacDonald. Indulgent, he owned two of almost everything. Two chickens with hair, two chickens that laid green eggs, two red hens that laid blue eggs, two llamas, two sheep, two ostrich, two sons, two dozen cats and dogs, too many horses, but only one goat named Zeke. No need for more goats. This one consumed all things, including the shirt off my back. One afternoon, I stood there dumbfounded and bare-chested as he devoured the shirt right off me. I learned fast to keep a safe distance from the beast called Zeke. My cousin Betsy knew the farm like the back of her hand and how to have fun with suburban cousins. In no time, she would lead us to the horse barn. Betsy said it would be a good idea for me to ride a stallion named Ringo Starr. But what about Paula the pony? Nah, Ringo was just right for you. I saddled up and followed Betsy out of the barn, across the farm, through the woods and by ponds with enormous bullfrogs. Board plane tour guide, she turned Ringo just enough for his eye to catch sight of the barn. Ringo lurched wildly and ran in full gallop toward it, with me holding on tight to the saddle horn, laughing my head off. As we raced uphill, my ass bumping all over the saddle, I heard Uncle Bob shout from the porch a stern, one-word command, "Duck!" In the nick of time, I ducked my head and just missed getting it knocked clean off my shoulders by the beam above the barn door. For my cousins, this beat the hell out of listening to bullfrogs.
So funny. I love how you just mixed in so much humor in this book. It makes it so easy to read.
Well, I always say, you know, there's nothing funny about Alzheimer's, but
right.
Of course the caregiving experience
right.
is, there's so many parts that are absurd and hilarious. And what I'll often say about caregiving is when you're laughing in that moment, all you can experience is the humor. And for a moment, it gives you a break from the pain, the guilt, the difficulty of being a caregiver. So I often found it in its own way a coping mechanism.
I like that, because you can say that about a lot of things in life. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Laughing. Laughing is so good for you. So where can folks find your book, Keith, and then tell us your website?
Sure. Amazon.com. Very straightforward. Missing Mary, A Crash Course in Alzheimer's Dementia. And then my website is jkeithmcmullin.com.
And I have to ask you, do you
sure.
have plans to do a book on tape?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll work on my voice and we'll put one on tape.
Thank you so much for being on The Writer's Voice. Today we had J. Keith McMullen. Missing Mary is the book, A Crash Course on Alzheimer's Dementia. Thank you so much for being here today, Keith.
Thank you.
I want to thank all the listeners out there for listening to The Writer's Voice on Virginia Voice. I'm Jennifer Robbins, your host. Thank you and have a great day.